learned. "Hey, Roger," Jamie said in response. "How are you?" With that, Roger and some of the others began to crowd around us. A few of the other kids ignored us and moved closer to the television now that there were free seats in the front row. Jamie introduced me to one of the older kids who'd come up and asked if I was her boyfriend. By his tone, I think that he had the same opinion of Jamie that most of the kids in our high school had. "He's just a friend," she said, "but he's very nice." Over the next hour, we visited with the children. I got a lot of questions about where I lived and whether my house was big or what kind of car I owned, and when we finally had to leave, Jamie promised that she'd be back soon. I noticed that she didn't promise I would be with her. While we were walking back to the car, I said, "They're a nice bunch of kids." I shrugged awkwardly. "I'm glad that you want to help them." Jamie turned to me and smiled. She knew there wasn't much to add after that, but I could tell she was still wondering what she was going to do for them that Christmas. Chapter 7. By early December, just over 2 weeks into rehearsals, the sky was winter dark before Miss Garber would let us leave, and Jamie asked me if I wouldn't mind walking her home. I don't know why she wanted me to. Beaufort wasn't exactly a hotbed of criminal activity back then. The only murder I'd ever heard about had occurred 6 years earlier when a guy was stabbed outside of Maurice's Tavern, which was a hangout for people like Lou, by the way. For an hour or so, it caused quite a stir, and phone lines buzzed all over town while nervous women wondered about the possibility of a crazed lunatic wandering the streets preying on innocent victims. Doors were locked, guns were loaded, men sat by the front windows looking for anyone out of the ordinary who might be creeping down the street. But the whole thing was over before the night was through when the guy walked into the police station to give himself up, explaining that it was a bar fight that got out of hand. Evidently, the victim had welched on a bet. The guy was charged with second-degree murder and got 6 years in the state penitentiary. The policemen in our town had the most boring jobs in the world, but they still liked to strut around with a swagger or sit in coffee shops while they talked about the big crime, as if they'd cracked the case of the Lindbergh baby. But Jamie's house was on the way to mine, and I couldn't say no without hurting her feelings. It wasn't that I liked her or anything, don't get the wrong idea. But when you've had to spend a few hours a day with someone, and you're going to continue doing that for at least another week, you don't want to do anything that might make the next day miserable for either of you. The play was going to be performed that Friday and Saturday, and lots of people were already talking about it. Miss Garber had been so impressed by Jamie and me that she kept telling everyone it was going to be the best play the school had ever done. She had a real flair for a promotion, too, we found out. We had one radio station in town, and they interviewed her over the air not once, but twice. "It's going to be marvelous," she pronounced. "Absolutely marvelous." She'd also called the newspaper, and they'd agreed to write an article about it, primarily because of the Jamie Egbert connection, even though everyone in town already knew about it. But Miss Garber was relentless, and just that day she'd told us the Playhouse was going to bring in extra seats to accommodate the extra-large crowd expected. The class sort of oohed and aahed like it was a big deal or something, but then I guess it was to some of them. Remember, we had guys like Eddie in class. He probably thought that this would be the only time in his life when someone might be interested in him. The sad thing was, he was probably right. You might think I'd be getting excited about it too, but I really wasn't. My friends were still teasing me at school, and I hadn't had an afternoon off in what seemed like forever. The only thing that kept me going was the fact that I was doing the right thing. I know it's not much, but frankly, it was all I had. Occasionally, I even felt sort of good about it, too, though I never admitted it to anyone. I could practically imagine the angels in heaven standing around and staring wistfully down at me with little tears filling the corners of their eyes, talking about how wonderful I was for all my sacrifices. So I was walking her home that first night thinking about this stuff when Jamie asked me a question. "Is it true you and your friends sometimes go to the graveyard at night?" Part of me was surprised that she was even interested. Though it wasn't exactly a secret, it didn't seem like the sort of thing she'd care about at all. "Yeah," I said, shrugging, "sometimes." "What do you do there besides eat peanuts?" I guess she knew about that, too. "I don't know," I said, "talk, joke around. It's just a place we like to go." "Does it ever scare you?"
"No," I answered. "Why? Would it scare you?"
"I don't know," she said. "It might."
Why?
Because I'd worry that I might do something wrong.
We don't do anything bad there. I mean, we don't knock over the tombstones or leave our trash around, I said. I didn't want to tell her about our conversations about Henry Preston because I knew that wasn't the sort of thing Jamie would want to hear about. Last week, Eric had wondered aloud how fast a guy like that could lie in bed and... well, you know.
Do you ever just sit around and listen to the sounds? She asked. Like the crickets chirping or the rustling of leaves when the wind blows? Or do you ever just lie on your backs and stare at the stars?
Even though she was a teenager and had been for 4 years, Jamie didn't know the first thing about teenagers. And trying to understand teenage boys for her was like trying to decipher the theory of relativity.
Not really, I said. She nodded a little. I think that's what I'd do if I were there. If I ever go, I mean. I just look around to really see the place, or sit quietly and listen.
This whole conversation struck me as strange, but I didn't press it, and we walked on in silence for a few moments. And since she'd asked a little about me, I sort of felt obliged to ask her about herself. I mean, she hadn't brought up the Lord's plan or anything, so it was the least I could do.
So, what do you do?
I asked, besides working with the orphans or helping critters or reading the Bible, I mean. It sounded ridiculous, even to me, I admit, but that's what she did. She smiled at me. I think she was surprised by my question and even more surprised at my interest in her.
I do a lot of things. I study for my classes. I spend time with my dad. We play gin rummy now and then. Things like that.
Do you ever just go off with friends and goof around?
No,
she said. And I could tell by the way she answered that even to her it was obvious that no one wanted her around much. I'll bet you're excited about going off to college next year, I said, changing the subject. It took her a moment to answer.
I don't think I'm going to go, she said matter-of-factly.
Her answer caught me off guard. Jamie had some of the highest grades in our senior class, and depending on how the last semester went, she might even end up valedictorian. We had a running pool going as to how many times she would mention the Lord's plan in her speech, by the way. My bet was 14, being that she only had 5 minutes. What about Mount Sermon? I thought that's where you were planning to go. You'd love a place like that, I offered. She looked at me with a twinkle in her eye.
You mean I'd fit right in there, don't you?
Those curveballs she sometimes threw could smack you right between the eyeballs. I didn't mean it that way, I said quickly. I just meant that I'd heard about how excited you were to be going there next year. She shrugged without really answering me, and to be honest, I didn't know what to make of it. By then we'd reached the front of her house, and we stopped on the sidewalk out front. From where I was standing, I could make out Hegbert's shadow in the living room through the curtains. The lamp was on, and he was sitting on the sofa by the window. His head was bowed like he was reading something. I assumed it was the Bible.
Thank you for walking me home, Landon, she said, and she glanced up at me for a moment before finally starting up the walk.
As I watched her go, I couldn't help but think that of all the times I'd ever talked to her, this was the strangest conversation we'd ever had. Despite the oddness of some of her answers, she seemed practically normal. The next night, as I was walking her home, she asked me about my father.
He's all right, I reckon, I said, but he's not around much. Do you miss that, not growing up with him around?
Sometimes.
I miss my mom, too, she said, even though I never even knew her.
It was the first time I had ever considered that Jamie and I might have something in common. I let that sink in for a while.
It must be hard for you, I said sincerely.
Even though my father's a stranger to me, at least he's still around. She looked up at me as we walked, and faced forward again. She tugged gently at her hair again. I was beginning to notice that she did this whenever she was nervous or wasn't sure what to say.
It is, sometimes. Don't get me wrong, I love my father with all my heart. But there are times when I wonder what it would have been like to have a mother around. I think she and I would have been able to talk about things in a way that my father and I can't.
I assumed she was talking about boys. It wasn't until later that I learned how wrong I was. What's it like living with your father? Is he like how he is in church?
No. He's actually got a pretty good sense of humor.
Egbert? I blurted out. I couldn't even imagine it. I think she was shocked to hear me call him by his first name, but she let me off the hook and didn't respond to my comment. Instead, she said, "Don't look so surprised. You'll like him once you get to know him." I doubt if I'll ever get to know him. "You never know, Landon," she said, smiling, "what the Lord's plan is." I hated when she said things like that. With her, you just knew she'd talk to the Lord every day, and you never knew what the big guy upstairs had told her. She might even have a direct ticket into heaven, if you know what I mean, being as how good a person she was. "How would I get to know him?" I asked. She didn't answer, but she smiled to herself, as if she knew some secret that she was keeping from me. Like I said, I hated it when she did that. The next night, we talked about her Bible. "Why do you always carry it with you?" I asked. Now, I assumed she carried the Bible around simply because she was the minister's daughter. It wasn't that big of an assumption, given how Egbert felt about scripture and all, but the Bible she carried was old, and the cover was kind of ratty-looking, and I figured that she'd be the kind of person who would buy a new one every year or so just to help out the Bible publishing industry or to show her renewed dedication to the Lord or something. She walked a few steps before answering. "It was my mother's," she said simply. "Oh," I said it like I'd stepped on someone's pet turtle, squashing it under my shoe. She looked at me. "It's okay, Landon. How could you have known?" "I'm sorry I asked." "Don't be. You didn't mean anything by it." She paused. "My mother and father were given this Bible for their wedding, but my mom was the one who claimed it first. She read it all the time, especially whenever she was going through a hard time in her life." I thought about the miscarriages. Jamie went on. "She loved to read it at night before she went to sleep, and she had it with her in the hospital when I was born. When my father found out that she had died, he carried the Bible and me out of the hospital at the same time." "I'm sorry," I said again. Whenever someone tells you something sad, it's the only thing you can think to say, even if you've already said it before. "It just gives me a way to be a part of her. Can you understand that?" She wasn't saying it sadly, just more to let me know the answer to my question. Somehow that made it worse. After she told me the story, I thought of her growing up with Egbert again, and I didn't really know what to say. As I was thinking about my answer, though, I heard a car blare its horn from behind us, and both Jamie and I stopped and turned around at the same time as we heard it pulling over to the side. Eric and Margaret were in the car, Eric on the driver's side, Margaret on the side closest to us. "Well, looky who we have here," Eric said as he leaned over the steering wheel so that I could see his face. I hadn't told him I'd been walking Jamie home, and in the curious way that teenage minds work, this new development took priority over anything that I was feeling about Jamie's story. "Hello, Eric. Hello, Margaret," Jamie said cheerfully. "Walking her home, Landon?" I could see the little devil behind Eric's smile. "Hey, Eric," I said, wishing he'd never seen me. "It's a beautiful night for strolling, isn't it?" Eric said. I think that because Margaret was between him and Jamie, he felt a little bolder than he usually was in Jamie's presence, and there was no way he could let this opportunity pass without sticking it to me. Jamie looked around and smiled. "Yes, it is." Eric looked around, too, with this wistful look in his eyes, before taking a deep breath. I could tell he was faking it. "Boy, it really is nice out there." He sighed and glanced toward us as he shrugged. "I'd offer you a ride, but it wouldn't be half as nice as actually walking under the stars, and I wouldn't want you two to miss it." He said this like he was doing us both a favor. "Oh, we're almost to my house anyway," Jamie said. "I was going to offer Landon a cup of cider. Would you like to meet us there? We have plenty." A cup of cider? At her house? She hadn't mentioned that. I put my hands in my pocket, wondering if this could get any worse. "Oh, no, that's all right. We're just heading off to Cecil's Diner." "On a school night?" she asked innocently. "Oh, we won't be out too late," he promised. "But we should probably be going. Enjoy your cider, you two." "Thanks for stopping to say hello," Jamie said, waving. Eric got the car rolling again, but slowly. Jamie probably thought he was a safe driver. He really wasn't, though he was good at getting out of trouble when he'd crashed into something. I remember one time when he told his mother that a cow had jumped out in front of the car, and that's why the grill and fender were damaged. "It happened so fast, Mom. A cow came out of nowhere. It just darted out in front of me, and I couldn't stop in time." Now, everyone knows cows don't exactly dart anywhere, but his mother believed him. She used to be a head cheerleader, too, by the way. Once they'd pulled out of sight, Jamie turned to me and smiled.
"You have nice friends, Landon."
"Sure I do." Notice the careful way I phrased my answer. After dropping Jamie off, no, I didn't stay for any cider, I started back to my house, grumbling the whole time. By then, Jamie's story had left me completely, and I could practically hear my friends laughing about me all the way from Cecil's Diner. See what happens when you're a nice guy? By the next morning, everyone at school knew I was walking Jamie home, and this started up a whole new round of speculation about the two of us. This time it was even worse than before. It was so bad that I had to spend my lunch break in the library just to get away from it all. That night the rehearsal was at the Playhouse. It was the last one before the show opened, and we had a lot to do. Right after school, the boys in drama class had to load all the props in the classroom into the rented truck to bring them to the Playhouse. The only problem was that Eddie and I were the only two boys, and he's not exactly the most coordinated individual in history. We'd be walking through a doorway carrying one of the heavier items, and his Whoville body would work against him. At every critical moment when I really needed his help to balance the load, he'd stumble over some dust or an insect on the floor, and the weight of the prop would come crashing down on my fingers, pinching them against the door jamb in the most painful way possible.
"Sorry," he'd say. "Did that hurt?"
I'd stifle the curses rising in my throat and bite out, "Just don't do it again." But he couldn't stop himself from stumbling around any more than he could stop the rain from falling. By the time we'd finished loading and unloading everything, my fingers looked like Toby's, the roving handyman. And the worst thing was, I didn't even get a chance to eat before rehearsal started. Moving the props had taken 3 hours, and we didn't finish setting them up until a few minutes before everyone else arrived to begin. With everything else that had happened that day, suffice it to say, I was in a pretty bad mood. I ran through my lines without even thinking about them, and Miss Garber didn't say the word marvelous all night long. She had this concerned look in her eyes afterward, but Jamie simply smiled and told her not to worry, that everything was going to be all right. I knew Jamie was just trying to make things better for me, but when she asked me to walk her home, I told her no. The Playhouse was in the middle of town, and to walk her home, I'd have to walk a good distance out of my way. Besides, I didn't want to be seen again doing it. But Miss Garber had overheard Jamie's request, and she said very firmly that I'd be glad to do it.
"You two can talk about the play," she said. "Maybe you can work out the kinks."
By kinks, of course, she meant me specifically. So, once more, I ended up walking Jamie home. But she could tell I wasn't really in the mood to talk, because I walked a little bit in front of her, my hands in my pockets, without even really turning back to see whether she was following. It went this way for the first few minutes, and I hadn't said a word to her.
"You're not in a very good mood, are you?" she finally asked. "You didn't even try tonight."
"You don't miss a thing, do you?" I said sarcastically without looking at her.
"Maybe I can help," she offered. She said it kind of happily, which made me even a little angrier.
"I doubt it," I snapped.
"Maybe if you told me what was wrong..."
I didn't let her finish. "Look," I said, stopping, turning to face her. "I've just spent all day hauling crap. I haven't eaten since lunch, and now I have to trek a mile out of my way to make sure you get home, when we both know you don't even need me to do it." It was the first time I'd ever raised my voice to her. To tell you the truth, it felt kind of good. It had been building up for a long time. Jamie was too surprised to respond, and I went on. "And the only reason I'm doing this is because of your father, who doesn't even like me. This whole thing is dumb, and I wish I'd never agreed to do it."
"You're just saying this because you're nervous about the play,"
I cut her off with a shake in my head. Once I got on a roll, it was sometimes hard for me to stop. I could take her optimism and cheerfulness only so long, and today wasn't the day to push me too far.
"Don't you get it?" I said, exasperated. "I'm not nervous about the play. I just don't want to be here. I don't want to walk you home. I don't want my friends to keep talking about me, and I don't want to spend time with you. You keep acting like we're friends, but we're not. We're not anything. I just want the whole thing to be over so I can go back to my normal life."
She looked hurt by my outburst, and to be honest, I couldn't blame her.
"I see," was all she said.
I waited for her to raise her voice at me, to defend herself, to make her case again, but she didn't. All she did was look toward the ground. I think part of her wanted to cry, but she didn't. And I finally stalked away, leaving her standing by herself. A moment later, though, I heard her start moving, too. She was about 5 yards behind me the rest of the way to her house, and she didn't try to talk to me again until she started up the walkway. I was already moving down the sidewalk when I heard her voice.
"Thank you for walking me home, Landon," she called out.
I winced as soon as she said it. Even when I was mean to her face and said the most spiteful things, she could find some reason to thank me. She was just that kind of girl, and I think I actually hated her for it. Or rather, I think, I hated myself. Chapter 8. The night of the play was cool and crisp. The sky absolutely clear, without a hint of clouds. We had to arrive an hour early, and I'd been feeling pretty bad all day about the way I'd talked to Jamie the night before. She'd never been anything but nice to me, and I knew that I'd been a jerk. I saw her in the hallways between classes, and I wanted to go up to apologize to her for what I'd said, but she'd sort of slipped back into the crowd before I got the chance. She was already at the playhouse by the time I finally arrived, and I saw her talking to Miss Garber and Hegbert off to one side over by the curtains. Everyone was in motion, working off nervous energy, but she seemed strangely lethargic. She hadn't put on her costume yet. She was supposed to wear a white, flowing dress to give that angelic appearance, and she was still wearing the same sweater she'd worn at school. Despite my trepidation at how she might react, I walked up to the three of them. "Hey, Jamie," I said. "Hello, Reverend, Miss Garber." Jamie turned to me.
"Hello, Landon," she said quietly.
I could tell she'd been thinking about the night before, too, because she didn't smile at me like she always did when she saw me. I asked if I could talk to her alone, and the two of us excused ourselves. I could see Hegbert and Miss Garber watching us as we took a few steps off to the side, out of hearing distance. I glanced around the stage nervously.
"I'm sorry about those things I said last night," I began.
"I know they probably hurt your feelings, and I was wrong to have said them." She looked at me as if wondering whether to believe me.
"Did you mean those things you said?" she finally asked.
"I was just in a bad mood, that's all. I get sort of wound up sometimes." I knew I hadn't really answered her question.
"I see," she said.
She said it as she had the night before, then turned toward the empty seats in the audience. Again, she had that sad look in her eyes.
"Look," I said, reaching for her hand, "I promise to make it up to you."
Don't ask me why I said it. It just seemed like the right thing to do at the moment. For the first time that night, she began to smile.
"Thank you," she said, turning to face me.
"Jamie?"
Jamie turned.
"Yes, Miss Garber? I think we're about ready for you."
Miss Garber was motioning with her hand.
"I've got to go," she said to me.
"I know." "Break a leg?" I said. Wishing someone luck before a play is supposed to be bad luck. That's why everyone tells you to break a leg. I let go of her hand.
"We both will. I promise."
After that, we had to get ready, and we went our separate ways. I headed toward the men's dressing room. The playhouse was fairly sophisticated, considering that it was located in Beaufort, with separate dressing rooms that made us feel as if we were actual actors, as opposed to students. My costume, which was kept at the playhouse, was already in the dressing room. Earlier in the rehearsals, we'd had our measurements taken so that they could be altered, and I was getting dressed when Eric walked in the door, unannounced. Eddie was still in the dressing room, putting on his mute bum's costume, and when he saw Eric, he got a look of terror in his eyes. At least once a week, Eric gave him a wedgie, and Eddie kind of hightailed it out of there as fast as he could, pulling one leg up on his costume on the way out the door. Eric ignored him and sat on the dressing table in front of the mirror.
"So,"
Eric said with a mischievous grin on his face. What are you going to do? I looked at him curiously.
What do you mean?
I asked. About the play, stupid. You going to flub up your lines or something? I shook my head. No. You going to knock the props over? Everyone knew about the props. I hadn't planned on it, I answered stoically.
You mean you're going to do this thing straight up?
I nodded. Thinking otherwise hadn't even occurred to me. He looked at me for a long time as if he were seeing someone he'd never seen before.
I guess you're finally growing up, Landon, he said at last.
Coming from Eric, I wasn't sure whether it was intended as a compliment. Either way, though, I knew he was right. In the play, Tom Thornton is amazed when he first sees the angel, which is why he goes around helping her as she shares Christmas with those less fortunate. The first words out of Tom's mouth are, "You're beautiful," and I was supposed to say them as if I meant them from the bottom of my heart. This was the pivotal moment in the entire play, and it sets the tone for everything else that happens afterward. The problem, however, was that I still hadn't nailed this line yet. Sure, I said the words, but they didn't come off too convincingly, seeing as I probably said the words like anyone would when looking at Jamie, with the exception of Hegbert. It was the only scene where Miss Garber had never said the word marvelous, so I was nervous about it. I kept trying to imagine someone else as the angel so that I could get it just right, but with all the other things I was trying to concentrate on, it kept getting lost in the shuffle. Jamie was still in her dressing room when the curtains finally opened. I didn't see her beforehand, but that was okay. The first few scenes didn't include her anyway. They were mainly about Tom Thornton and his relationship with his daughter. Now, I didn't think I'd be too nervous when I stepped out on stage, being that I'd rehearsed so much, but it hits you right between the eyes when it actually happens. The playhouse was absolutely packed, and as Miss Garber had predicted, they'd had to set up two extra rows of seats all the way across the back. Normally, the place sat 400, but with those seats, there were at least another 50 people sitting down. In addition, people were standing against the walls, packed like sardines. As soon as I stepped on stage, everyone was absolutely quiet. The crowd, I noticed, was mainly old ladies of the blue-haired type, the kind that play bingo and drink Bloody Marys at Sunday brunch, though I could see Eric sitting with all my friends near the back row. It was downright eerie, if you know what I mean, to be standing in front of them while everyone waited for me to say something. So I did the best I could to put it out of my mind as I did the first few scenes in the play. Sally, the one-eyed wonder, was playing my daughter, by the way, because she was sort of small, and we went through our scenes just as we'd rehearsed them. Neither of us blew our lines, though we weren't spectacular or anything. When we closed the curtains for Act Two, we had to quickly reset the props. This time, everyone pitched in, and my fingers escaped unscathed because I avoided Eddie at all costs. I still hadn't seen Jamie. I guess she was exempt from moving props because her costume was made of light material and would rip if she caught it on one of those nails. But I didn't have much time to think about her because of all we had to do. The next thing I knew, the curtain was opening again, and I was back in Hegbert Sullivan's world, walking past storefronts and looking in windows for the music box my daughter wants for Christmas. My back was turned from where Jamie entered, but I heard the crowd collectively draw a breath as soon as she appeared on stage. I thought it was silent before, but now it went absolutely hush still. Just then, from the corner of my eye and off to the side of the stage, I saw Hegbert's jaw quivering. I readied myself to turn around, and when I did, I finally saw what it was all about. For the first time since I'd known her, her honey-colored hair wasn't pulled into a tight bun. Instead, it was hanging loosely, longer than I imagined, reaching below her shoulder blades. There was a trace of glitter in her hair, and it caught the stage lights, sparkling like a crystal halo. Set against her flowing white dress, tailored exactly for her, it was absolutely amazing to behold. She didn't look like the girl I'd grown up with or the girl I'd come recently to know. She wore a touch of makeup, too. Not a lot, just enough to bring out the softness of her features. She was smiling slightly as if she were holding a secret close to her heart, just like the part called for her to do. She looked exactly like an angel. I know my jaw dropped a little, and I just stood there looking at her for what seemed like a long time, shocked into silence, until I suddenly remembered that I had a line I had to deliver. I took a deep breath, then slowly let it out. "You're beautiful," I finally said to her. And I think everyone in the whole auditorium, from the blue-haired ladies in front to my friends in the back row, knew that I actually meant it. I'd nailed that line for the very first time. Chapter 9. To say that the play was a smashing success was to put it mildly. The audience laughed and the audience cried, which is pretty much what they were supposed to do. But because of Jamie's presence, it really became something special. And I think everyone in the cast was as shocked as I was at how well the whole thing had come off. They all had that same look I did when I first saw her, and it made the play that much more powerful when they were performing their parts. We finished the first performance without a hitch, and the next evening even more people showed up, if you can believe it. Even Eric came up to me afterward and congratulated me, which after what he'd said to me before was somewhat of a surprise. "The two of you did good," he said simply. "I'm proud of you, buddy." While he said it, Miss Garber was crying out "marvelous" to anyone who would listen to her, or who just happened to be walking past, repeating it over and over so much that I kept on hearing it long after I went to bed that night. I looked for Jamie after we'd pulled the curtains closed for the final time, and spotted her off to the side with her father. He had tears in his eyes. It was the first time I'd ever seen him cry, and Jamie went into his arms, and they held each other for a long time. He was stroking her hair and whispering "my angel" to her while her eyes were closed, and even I felt myself choking up. The right thing, I realized, wasn't so bad after all. After they finally let go of each other, Hagbert proudly motioned for her to visit with the rest of the cast, and she got a boatload of congratulations from everyone backstage. She knew she'd done well, though she kept on telling people she didn't know what all the fuss was about. She was her normal, cheerful self, but with her looking so pretty, it came across in a totally different way. I stood in the background, letting her have her moment, and I'll admit there was a part of me that felt like old Hagbert. I couldn't help but be happy for her and a little proud as well. When she finally saw me standing off to one side, she excused herself from the others and walked over, finally stopping when she was close. Looking up at me, she smiled. "Thank you, Landon, for what you did. You made my father very happy." "You're welcome," I said, meaning it. The strange thing was, when she said it, I realized that Hagbert would be driving her home, and for once I wished that I would have had the opportunity to walk her there. The following Monday was our last week of school before Christmas break, and finals were scheduled in every class. In addition, I had to finish my application for UNC, which I had sort of been putting off because of all the rehearsals. I planned on hitting the books pretty hard that week, then doing the application at night before I went to bed. Even so, I couldn't help but think about Jamie. Jamie's transformation during the play had been startling, to say the least, and I assumed it had signaled a change in her. I don't know why I thought that way, but I did, and so I was amazed when she showed up our first morning back dressed like her usual self. Brown sweater, hair in a bun, plaid skirt and all. One look was all it took, and I couldn't help but feel sorry for her. She'd been regarded as normal, even special, over the weekend, or so it had seemed, but she'd somehow let it slip away. Oh, people were a little nicer to her, and the ones who hadn't talked to her yet told her what a good job she'd done, too, but I could tell right off that it wasn't going to last. Attitudes forged since childhood are hard to break, and part of me wondered if it might even get worse for her after this. Now that people actually knew she could look normal, they might even become more heartless. I wanted to talk to her about my impressions, I really did, but I was planning to do so after the week was over. Not only did I have a lot to do, but I wanted a little time to think of the best way to tell her. To be honest, I was still feeling a little guilty about the things I had said to her on our last walk home, and it wasn't just because the play had turned out great. It had more to do with the fact that in all our time together, Jamie had never once been anything but kind. And I knew that I'd been wrong. I didn't think she wanted to talk to me either, to tell you the truth. I knew she could see me hanging out with my friends at lunch while she sat off in the corner reading her Bible, but she never made a move toward us. But as I was leaving school that day, I heard her voice behind me, asking me if I wouldn't mind walking her home. Even though I wasn't ready to tell her yet about my thoughts, I agreed. For old time's sake, you see. A minute later, Jamie got down to business.
"Do you remember those things you said on our last walk home?" she asked.
I nodded, wishing she hadn't brought it up.
"You promised to make it up to me," she said.
For a moment I was confused. I thought I'd done that already with my performance in the play. Jamie went on.
"Well, I've been thinking about what you could do," she continued, without letting me get a word in edgewise, "and this is what I've come up with."
She asked if I wouldn't mind gathering the pickle jars and coffee cans she'd set out in businesses all over town early in the year. They sat on the counters, usually near the cash register, so that people could drop their loose change in. The money was to go to the orphans. Jamie never wanted to ask people straight out for the money. She wanted them to give voluntarily. That, in her mind, was the Christian thing to do. I remembered seeing the containers in places like Cecil's Diner and the Crown Theater. My friends and I used to toss paper clips and slugs in there when the cashiers weren't looking, since they sounded sort of like a coin being dropped inside. Then we'd chuckle to ourselves about how we were putting something over on Jamie. We used to joke about how she'd open one of her cans expecting something good because of the weight, and she'd dump it out and find nothing but slugs and paper clips. Sometimes when you remember the things you used to do, it makes you wince. And that's exactly what I did. Jamie saw the look on my face.
"You don't have to do it," she said, obviously disappointed. "I was just thinking that since Christmas is coming up so quickly and I don't have a car, it'll simply take me too long to collect them all."
"No," I said, cutting her off. "I'll do it. I don't have much to do anyway." So that's what I did, starting Wednesday, even though I had tests to study for, even with that application needing to be finished. Jamie had given me a list of every place she'd placed a can, and I borrowed my mom's car and started at the far end of town the following day. She'd put out about 60 cans in all, and I figured that it would take only a day to collect them all. Compared to putting them out, it would be a piece of cake. It had taken Jamie almost 6 weeks to do, because she'd first had to find 60 empty jars and cans, and then she could put out only two or three a day, since she didn't have a car and could carry only so many at a time. When I started out, I felt sort of funny about being the one who picked up the cans and jars, being that it was Jamie's project. But I kept telling myself that Jamie had asked me to help. I went from business to business, collecting the cans and jars, and by the end of the first day, I realized it was going to take a little longer than I'd thought. I'd picked up only about 20 containers or so because I'd forgotten one simple fact of life in Beaufort. In a small town like this, it was impossible to simply run inside and grab the can without chatting with the proprietor or saying hello to someone else you might recognize. It just wasn't done. So I'd sit there while some guy would be talking about the marlin he'd hooked last fall, or they'd ask me how school was going, and mentioned that they needed a hand unloading a few boxes in the back, or maybe they wanted my opinion on whether they should move the magazine rack over to the other side of the store. Jamie, I knew, would have been good at this, and I tried to act like I thought she would want me to. It was her project, after all. To keep things moving, I didn't stop to check the take in between the businesses. I just dumped one jar or can into the next, combining them as I went along. By the end of the first day, all the change was packed in two large jars, and I carried them up to my room. I saw a few bills through the glass, not too many, but I wasn't actually nervous until I emptied the contents onto my floor and saw that the change consisted primarily of pennies. Though there weren't nearly as many slugs or paper clips as I thought there might be, I was still disheartened when I counted up the money. There was $20.32. Even in 1958, that wasn't a lot of money, especially when divided among 30 kids. I didn't get discouraged, though. Thinking that it was a mistake, I went out the next day, hauled a few dozen boxes, and chatted with another 20 proprietors while I collected cans and jars. The take? $23.89. The third day was even worse. After counting up the money, even I couldn't believe it. There was only $11.52. Those were from the businesses down by the waterfront where the tourists and teenagers like me hung out. We were really something, I couldn't help but think. Seeing how little had been collected in all, $55.73, made me feel awful, especially considering that the jars had been out for almost a whole year and that I myself had seen them countless times. That night I was supposed to call Jamie to tell her the amount I'd collected, but I just couldn't do it. She had told me how she'd wanted something extra special this year, and this wasn't going to do it. Even I knew that. Instead, I lied to her and told her that I wasn't going to count the total until the two of us could do it together, because it was her project, not mine. It was just too depressing. I promised to bring over the money the following afternoon, after school let out. The next day was December 21, the shortest day of the year. Christmas was only 4 days away. "Landon," she said to me after counting it up, "this is a miracle." "How much is there?" I asked. I knew exactly how much it was. "There's almost $247 here." She was absolutely joyous as she looked up at me. Since Hegbert was home, I was allowed to sit in the living room, and that's where Jamie had counted the money. It was stacked in neat little piles all over the floor, almost all quarters and dimes. Hegbert was in the kitchen at the table writing his sermon, and even he turned his head when he heard the sound of her voice. "Do you think that's enough?" I asked innocently. Little tears were coming down her cheeks as she looked around the room, still not believing what she was seeing right in front of her. Even after the play, she hadn't been nearly this happy. She looked right at me. "It's wonderful," she said, smiling. There was more emotion than I'd ever heard in her voice before. "Last year I only collected $70. "I'm glad it worked out better this year," I said through the lump that had formed in my throat. "If you hadn't placed those jars out so early in the year, you might not have collected nearly as much." I know I was lying, but I didn't care. For once, it was the right thing to do. I didn't help Jamie pick out the toys. I figured she'd know better what the kids would want anyway, but she'd insisted that I go with her to the orphanage on Christmas Eve so that I could be there when the children opened their gifts. "Please, Landon," she'd said, and with her being so excited and all, I just didn't have the heart to turn her down. So 3 days later, while my father and mother were at a party at the mayor's house, I dressed in a houndstooth jacket and my best tie and walked to my mom's car with Jamie's present beneath my arm. I'd spent my last few dollars on a nice sweater because that was all I could think to get her. She wasn't exactly the easiest person to shop for. I was supposed to be at the orphanage at 7, but the bridge was up near the Moorhead City port, and I had to wait until an outbound freighter slowly made its way down the channel. As a result, I arrived a few minutes late. The front door was already locked by that time, and I had to pound on it until Mr. Jenkins finally heard me. He fiddled through his set of keys until he found the right one, and a moment later he opened the door. I stepped inside, patting my arms to ward off the chill. "Oh, you're here," he said happily. "We've been waiting for you. Come on, I'll take you to where everyone is." He led me down the hall to the rec room, the same place I'd been before. I paused for just a moment to exhale deeply before finally heading in. It was even better than I'd imagined. In the center of the room, I saw a giant tree decorated with tinsel and colored lights and 100 different handmade ornaments. Beneath the tree, spread in all directions, were wrapped gifts of every size and shape. They were piled high, and the children were on the floor, sitting close together in a large semicircle. They were dressed in their best clothes, I assumed. The boys wore navy blue slacks and white-collared shirts, while the girls had on navy skirts and long-sleeved blouses. They all looked as if they'd cleaned up before the big event, and most of the boys had had their hair cut. On the table beside the door, there was a bowl of punch and platters of cookies shaped like Christmas trees and sprinkled with green sugar. I could see some adults sitting with the children. A few of the smaller kids were sitting on the adults' laps, their faces rapt with attention as they listened to "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." I didn't see Jamie, though, at least not right off the bat. It was her voice that I recognized first. She was the one reading the story, and I finally located her. She was sitting on the floor in front of the tree with her legs bent beneath her. To my surprise, I saw that tonight her hair hung loosely, just as it had the night of the play. Instead of the old brown cardigan I'd seen so many times, she was wearing a red V-neck sweater that somehow accentuated the color of her light blue eyes. Even without the sparkles in her hair or a long white flowing dress, the sight of her was arresting. Without even noticing it, I'd been holding my breath, and I could see Mr. Jenkins smiling at me. I exhaled and smiled, trying to regain control. Jamie paused only once to look up from the story. She noticed me standing in the doorway, then went back to reading to the children. It took her another minute or so to finish, and when she did, she stood up and smoothed her skirt, then walked around the children to make her way toward me. Not knowing where she wanted me to go, I stayed where I was. By then, Mr. Jenkins had slipped away. "I'm sorry we started without you," she said when she finally reached me, "but the kids were just so excited." "It's okay," I said, smiling, thinking how nice she looked. "I'm so glad you could come." "So am I." Jamie smiled and reached for my hand to lead the way. "Come on with me," she said. "Help me hand out the gifts." We spent the next hour doing just that, and we watched as the children opened them one by one. Jamie had shopped all over town, picking up a few things for each child in the room, individual gifts that they'd never received before. The gifts that Jamie bought weren't the only ones the children received, however. Both the orphanage and the people who worked there had bought some things as well. As paper was tossed around the room in excited frenzy, there were squeals of delight everywhere. To me, at least, it seemed that all of the children had received far more than they'd expected, and they kept thanking Jamie over and over. By the time the dust had finally settled and all the children's gifts were opened, the atmosphere began to calm down. The room was tidied up by Mr. Jenkins and a woman I'd never met, and some of the smaller children were beginning to fall asleep beneath the tree. Some of the older ones had already gone back to their rooms with their gifts, and they dimmed the overhead lights on the way out the door. The tree lights cast an ethereal glow as Silent Night played softly on a phonograph that had been set up in the corner. I was still sitting on the floor next to Jamie, who was holding a young girl who'd fallen asleep in her lap. Because of all the commotion, we hadn't really had a chance to talk, not that either of us had minded. We were both gazing up at the lights on the tree, and I wondered what Jamie was thinking. If truth be told, I didn't know, but she had a tender look about her. I thought, no, I knew she was pleased with how the evening had gone, and deep down, so was I. To this point, it was the best Christmas Eve I'd ever spent. I glanced at her. With the lights glowing on her face, she looked as pretty as anyone I'd ever seen. "I bought you something," I finally said to her. "A gift, I mean." I spoke softly so I wouldn't wake the little girl, and I hoped it would hide the nervousness in my voice. She turned from the tree to face me, smiling softly. "You didn't have to do that." She kept her voice low, too, and it sounded almost musical. "I know," I said, "but I wanted to." I had kept the gift off to one side, and I reached for it, handing the gift-wrapped package to her. "Could you open it for me? My hands are kind of full right now." She looked down at the little girl, then back to me. "You don't have to open it now if you'd rather not," I said, shrugging. "It's really not that big of a deal." "Don't be silly," she said. "I would only open it in front of you." To clear my mind, I looked at the gift and started opening it, picking at the tape so that it wouldn't make much noise, then unwrapping the paper until I reached the box. After setting the paper off to the side, I lifted the cover and pulled out the sweater, holding it up to show her. It was brown, like the one she usually wore, but I figured she could use a new one. Compared with the joy I'd seen earlier, I didn't expect much of a reaction. "See, that's all. I told you it wasn't much," I said. I hoped she wasn't disappointed in it. "It's beautiful, Landon," she said earnestly. "I'll wear it the next time I see you. Thank you." We sat quietly for a moment, and once again I began to look at the lights. "I brought you something, too," Jamie finally whispered. She looked toward the tree, and my eyes followed her gaze. Her gift was still beneath the tree, partially hidden by the stand, and I reached for it. It was rectangular, flexible, and a little heavy. I brought it to my lap and held it there without even trying to open it. "Open it," she said, looking right at me. You can't give this to me, I said breathlessly. I already knew what was inside, and I couldn't believe what she had done. My hands began to tremble.
Please, she said to me with the kindest voice I'd ever heard. Open it. I want you to have it.
Reluctantly, I slowly unwrapped the package. When it was finally free of the paper, I held it gently, afraid to damage it. I stared at it, mesmerized, and slowly ran my hand over the top, brushing my fingers over the well-worn leather as tears filled my eyes. Jamie reached out and rested her hand on mine. It was warm and soft. I glanced at her, not knowing what to say. Jamie had given me her Bible.
Thank you for doing what you did, she whispered to me. It was the best Christmas I've ever had.
I turned away without responding and reached off to the side where I'd set my glass of punch. The chorus of Silent Night was still playing, and the music filled the room. I took a sip of the punch, trying to soothe the sudden dryness in my throat. As I drank, all the times I'd spent with Jamie came flooding into my mind. I thought about the homecoming dance and what she'd done for me that night. I thought about the play and how angelic she'd looked. I thought about the times I'd walked her home and how I'd helped collect jars and cans filled with pennies for the orphans. As these images were going through my head, my breathing suddenly went still. I looked at Jamie, then up to the ceiling and around the room, doing my best to keep my composure, then back to Jamie again. She smiled at me, and I smiled at her, and all I could do was wonder how I'd ever fallen in love with a girl like Jamie Sullivan. Chapter 10 I drove Jamie home from the orphanage later that night. At first I wasn't sure whether I should pull the old yawn move and put my arm around her shoulder, but to be honest, I didn't know exactly how she was feeling about me. Granted, she'd given me the most wonderful gift I'd ever received, and even though I'd probably never open it and read it like she did, I knew it was like giving a piece of herself away. But Jamie was the type of person who would donate a kidney to a stranger she met walking down the street if he really needed one, so I wasn't exactly sure what to make of it. Jamie had told me once that she wasn't a dimwit, and I guess I finally came to the conclusion that she wasn't. She may have been, well, different, but she'd figured out what I'd done for the orphans. And looking back, I think she knew even as we were sitting on the floor of her living room. When she'd called it a miracle, I guess she was talking specifically about me. Egbert, I remembered, came into the room as Jamie and I were talking about it, but he really didn't have much to say. Old Egbert hadn't been himself lately, at least as far as I could tell. Oh, his sermons were still on the money, and he still talked about the fornicators, but lately his sermons were shorter than usual, and occasionally he'd pause right in the middle of one, and this strange look would come over him, kind of like he was thinking of something else, something sad. I didn't know what to make of it, being that I didn't really know him that well. And Jamie, when she talked about him, seemed to describe someone else entirely. I could no more imagine Egbert with a sense of humor than I could imagine two moons in the sky. So anyway, he came into the room while we counted the money, and Jamie stood up with those tears in her eyes, and Egbert didn't even seem to realize I was there. He told her that he was proud of her and that he loved her. But then he shuffled back to the kitchen to continue working on his sermon. He didn't even say hello. Now, I knew I hadn't exactly been the most spiritual kid in the congregation, but I still found his behavior sort of odd. As I was thinking about Egbert, I glanced at Jamie sitting beside me. She was looking out the window with a peaceful look on her face, kind of smiling, but far away at the same time. I smiled. Maybe she was thinking about me. My hand started scooting across the seat, closer to hers. But before I reached it, Jamie broke the silence. Landon, she finally asked as she turned toward me, do you ever think about God? I pulled my hand back. Now, when I thought about God, I usually pictured him like those old paintings I'd seen in churches, a giant hovering over the landscape wearing a white robe with long flowing hair, pointing his finger, or something like that. But I knew she wasn't talking about that. She was talking about the Lord's plan. It took a moment for me to answer. Sure, I said. Sometimes, I reckon.
Do you ever wonder why things have to turn out the way they do?
I nodded uncertainly.
I've been thinking about it a lot lately.
Even more than usual, I wanted to ask, but I didn't. I could tell she had more to say, and I stayed quiet.
I know the Lord has a plan for us all, but sometimes I just don't understand what the message can be. Does that ever happen to you?
She said this as though it were something I thought about all the time. Well, I said, trying to bluff, I don't think that we're meant to understand it all the time. I think that sometimes we just have to have faith. It was a pretty good answer, I admit. I guess that my feelings for Jamie were making my brain work a little faster than usual. I could tell she was thinking about my answer.
Yes, she finally said. You're right.
I smiled to myself and changed the subject, since talking about God wasn't the sort of thing that made a person feel romantic. You know, I said casually, it sure was nice tonight when we were sitting by the tree earlier.
Yes, it was, she said.
Her mind was still elsewhere. And you sure look nice, too.
Thank you.
This wasn't working too well. Can I ask you a question? I finally said, in the hopes of bringing her back to me.
Sure, she said.
I took a deep breath. After church tomorrow, and, well, after you spent some time with your father, I mean, I paused and looked at her. Would you mind coming over to my house for Christmas dinner? Even though her face was still turned toward the window, I could see the faint outlines of a smile as soon as I'd said it.
Yes, Landon, I would like that very much.
I sighed with relief, not believing I'd actually asked her and still wondering how all this had happened. I drove down streets where windows were decorated with Christmas lights and through the Beaufort City Square. A couple of minutes later, when I reached across the seat, I finally took hold of her hand. And to complete the perfect evening, she didn't pull it away. When we pulled up in front of her house, the lights in the living room were still on, and I could see Hegbert behind the curtains. I supposed he was waiting up because he wanted to hear how the evening went at the orphanage. Either that, or he wanted to make sure I didn't kiss his daughter on the doorstep. I knew he'd frown on that sort of thing. I was thinking about that, what to do when we finally said goodbye, I mean, when we got out of the car and started toward the door. Jamie was quiet and content at the same time, and I think she was happy that I'd asked her to come over the next day. Since she'd been smart enough to figure out what I'd done for the orphans, I figured that maybe she'd been smart enough to figure out the homecoming situation as well. In her mind, I think even she realized that this was the first time I'd actually asked her to join me of my own volition. Just as we got to her steps, I saw Hegbert peek out from behind the curtains and pull his face back. With some parents, like Angela's, for instance, that meant they knew you were home and they had about another minute or so before they'd open the door. Usually that gave you both time to sort of bat your eyes at each other while each of you worked up the nerve to actually kiss. It usually took about that long. Now, I didn't know if Jamie would kiss me. In fact, I actually doubted that she would. But with her looking so pretty, with her hair down and all, and everything that had happened tonight, I didn't want to miss the opportunity if it came up. I could feel the little butterflies already starting to form in my stomach when Hegbert opened the door. "I heard you pull up," he said quietly. His skin was that sallow color, as usual, but he looked tired. "Hello, Reverend Sullivan," I said dejectedly.
"Hi, Daddy," Jamie said happily a second later. "I wish you could have come tonight. It was wonderful."
"I'm so glad for you." He seemed to gather himself then and cleared his throat. "I'll give you a bit to say goodnight. I'll leave the door open for you." He turned around and went back into the living room. From where he sat down, I knew he could still see us. He pretended to be reading, though I couldn't see what was in his hands.
"I had a wonderful time tonight, Landon," Jamie said.
"So did I," I answered, feeling Hegbert's eyes on me. I wondered if he knew I'd been holding her hand during the car ride home.
"What time should I come over tomorrow?" she asked.
Hegbert's eyebrow raised just a little.
"I'll come over to get you. Is 5 o'clock okay?"
She looked over her shoulder.
"Daddy, would you mind if I visited with Landon and his parents tomorrow?"
Hagbert brought his hand to his eyes and started rubbing them. He sighed. "If it's important to you, you can," he said. Not the most stirring vote of confidence I'd ever heard, but it was good enough for me. "What should I bring?" she asked. In a